Morning. The court's ready to hear argument in Chavin versus PNC. You ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Morning, Mr. Brown.
I know you have a big case coming up at noon, so we'll try to move this one along quickly, at least in my part of will.
Well, you have our undivided attention.
I understand that, but I'll try not to overdo my welcome. This case has been here before, as the court knows. But we're here again this time. The basis for this appeal really is an abuse of discretion with respect to the court below, and it centers on the award of counsel fees and expenses from the trust and the denial of the surcharge motion made by us on behalf of the appellants. The facts are many, and I tried to set them forth in the brief, but really it's a simple case, I think, for the court to consider. There are really three components to it. There were estate expenses that were charged to this trust of over $100,000. They're not expenses that were incurred for the trust, but for the state. There's a second aspect of our appeal. From the time we were in this court before, and this court issues a mandate reversing the court below, directing it to go back, all sorts of proceedings took place over the next 14 months in that court, as a result of which the trust has been assessed another, best I make it, $35,000 in fees and expenses for counsel for PNC in its capacity as a fiduciary. The third aspect, of course, is the denial of the surcharge application. When all this finally wound down at the end, since we were going to court anyway, we went ahead and filed a surcharge application to see if we could get back all the monies that were improperly expended on behalf of the trust, as best we can tell. That was in the sum of $103,000, and the court denied that. What it really boils down to is more than $130,000 in fees and expenses have been assessed against the trust and therefore against the funds that this court previously found were distributable to the appellants. And the application on our part to be reimbursed for improper expenditures was denied. Background facts, I'm not going to go into them. This is Chavin. Florence Chavin had a trust, the court may recall, that provided that upon her death, among other things, after payment of certain things, whatever was left over, the trustee would distribute to her son, Leslie, if he then be living, if he not then be living, to her grandsons, the appellants in this court. Leslie survived his mother, but unfortunately was murdered in Brazil, where he lived some 3 months thereafter. And PNC, as the fiduciary, as the trustee, and as also the executor for Mrs. Chavin's estate, made the determination that the distribution of the trust proceeds had vested in Leslie upon the death of Mrs. Chavin afforded to go on that basis. Because Leslie lived in Brazil and they were fearful of what might have happened in Brazil to the funds, if a Brazilian executor could get hold of them, they retained counsel, Cooch and Taylor firm, to advise them with respect to, I guess, international law, and they also retained an attorney down in Brazil, Ms. Zacharias, to assist them down there. PNC ended up being appointed administrator CTA of Leslie's estate up here. When that was done, they transferred $720,000 from the trust into the estate, and then apparently proceeded to defend those estate trusts against something from Brazil that never came. There was no attack, to my knowledge. But as a result of all of that, the appellants did bring an action in the Court of Chancery seeking to be declared beneficiaries of the trust. PNC and the sole beneficiary of Leslie's estate, a gentleman named Harlan Miller, moved for summary judgment. The court below granted it. We appealed, and this court, as you know, reversed on appeal, as properly it should, finding that, as a matter of common sense, everybody looked at it should have known what Mrs. Chavin had in mind if Leslie wasn't alive to take the distribution of the trust. She wanted it to go to her grandsons, not to his estate, and pass to some distant cousin. Now, that's when everything started here. This court issued a mandate. You reversed it and issued a mandate, sent it back to the court below with instructions to take such further proceedings as may be necessary in conformity with this opinion. Thereafter, all sorts of things happened. And I'll run through them just as briefly as I can, but just to give you the flavor of it. Mr. Miller, the beneficiary of the estate, filed something called an omnibus motion. He wanted the statute of limitations defense heard. He and PNC had defendant in the court below on statute of limitations, vice chancellor issued a ruling, didn't discuss that, he ruled on other grounds. Came up here, they argued a statute of limitations before this court. This court reversed but didn't say anything about statute of limitations defense. They moved for re-argument, saying, having considered our statute of limitations defense, this court denied the re-argument for that opinion. It went back. Mr. Miller filed a motion. He wanted statute of limitations defense considered. And the court said, fine, we'll go into that. He also filed in his motion, he sought relief because this court had denied him due process because they'd entered, he directed a judgment be entered in our favor down there when we hadn't moved for summary judgment, and it was something that you relied on deposition testimony, not testimony in hearing. Things were completely absurd as far as I'm concerned. And he also wanted time to develop facts to refute the facts relied on by this court. And that was the first motion. That should have been denied out of hand, as far as I'm concerned. It wasn't. There was briefing on it. But the Vice Chancellor eventually said, issued an opinion saying, probably I can't consider this because the Supreme Court already had it before it. And that's the end of it. You would have thought maybe the case would have ended there, but it didn't. Mr. Miller then filed a motion to stay any distribution to the appellants pending an appeal he wanted to take. Well, the Vice Chancellor didn't necessarily grant that, but he did it eventually on June the 30th, issued or signed an order, which we think should have been signed long before, directing the trustee to pay the proceeds of the trust to our clients. Mr. Miller then, undauntedly, he filed another motion because on June the 30th, the governor signed a statute into law that the trust and estate section had rushed down and apparently got through the legislature as a result of your decision.
Where were you to tell them what a good decision we had rendered?
Well, I told everybody I could, but they didn't want to hear it. Mr. Gordon tried to do that at the estates and trust section, but generally got shouted down. However, because of that, the motion was a Rule 60B motion filed to open up the judgment because the legislative act had overruled your decision back in January. So we had to suffer through that a little bit, and as a result of that, the court below amended its order and said, don't distribute, when you distribute the money to the appellants, have them pay it in court. And so that's what we did. We got a distribution and we paid it in court. In effect, we posted the appeal bond for Mr. Miller's appeal. He took an appeal, but he later withdrew it. So at that point, we were back in court below. We finally got our money distributed to us, and then PNC started filing motions for fees. They filed one on December the 10th. For fees with respect to their services, counsel's fees for representing the trustee. A month later, they filed another motion seeking fees from the trust to pay estate expenses. And finally, at the end of all that, we filed a motion for a surcharge. And depositions were taken, discovery was taken, PNC wanted a hearing, wanted discovery. They took the depositions of Mr. Gordon and Mr. Penza over my motion for protective order. Finally, we had a hearing in April. And the Vice Chancellor, after considering everything, ruled 100% in favor of the PNC on everything. Yeah. That's the decision we're appealing from here.
Now, and these are the fees, some of the fees incurred by PNC with regard to actions brought by Mr. Miller?
I think so, yes. They may differ on that.
And then, so what's the relationship reflected in the record between PNC and Mr. Miller? Was it an adversarial relationship?
Not from our standpoint. PNC made a decision, as best we can tell early on, that Mr. Miller was the one entitled to take the assets of the trust because he was the sole beneficiary of Leslie's estate, and they used the trust to invest it in Leslie when Mrs. Chapin died. And they basically championed the cause of Mr. Miller all the way through.
After the remand?
Well, let me address that specifically. They didn't take an aggressive position after the remand to say, as they indicated in brief, they took a neutral position. They didn't do anything after the remand. But in our view, Mr. Miller was running with the ball then. He was filing all these things. They weren't opposing them. My view is that after this court ruled and said where the distribution went, that as a fiduciary, they should have been on our side when they went back. But they were neutral at best.
Well, help us understand in the exercise of discretion. If Miller was represented by Thomas Herlihy and you were representing your client, PNC is kind of in the middle. And they had to be present, they had to be represented as long as people were litigating. Why was it an abuse of discretion to award them fees as long as the real parties and interests were in court in a dispute?
Well, Your Honor, again, I don't necessarily agree that they were neutral. I think, in our view at least, they were team all the way through. And Mr. Miller's applications was somehow trying to get around just this court's decision. They didn't have any problem with that, and they went along with it. And I don't know, it just seems to me that they didn't object, they didn't take any opposing position to it, and in our view, all those proceedings, however it came about, were unnecessary and didn't really follow this court's mandate. I think all you needed when this case went back was an order directing PNC to distribute the proceeds of the trust to our clients and reserve jurisdiction to consider their application for a fee award. And we've not opposed the fees that PNC incurred up through this court's decision. So that should have been the end of it. We went through 14 months of matters down there in the court below after the remand of this court. And in the process, PNC's counsel incurred another $35,000 in fees, which the court assessed against us. And that, keep in mind, my two opponents haven't done anything in this case. They haven't even appeared, haven't had to. They're beneficiaries of their grandmother's trust. And that's their whole role in it. And somehow, the problem we have here is that, in all fairness, I'm sure PNC was acting with good intentions, what it thought was right, but it made a mistake. Distributed the trust funds to an estate when it shouldn't have. And as a result of that, we've got $130,000 overall expenses being taken out of that trust to pay for its expenses, and expenses of lawyers, and people that they hire, defending the estate, not the trust. And if this decision's affirmed, PNC, which made a mistake, comes out cost-free. Hadn't cost them anything. It's going to cost my clients $130,000, plus they've had their own litigation expenses to bear along the way. And we just think under the circumstances that this, you just look at the overall transaction, and we don't really see how that can constitute proper exercise of discretion. But let me, just before my time expires, go to the reasons that the court below gave in making its decision. They were basically fourfold. The court said, that it was necessary to do this, because basically you had Mrs. Chavin's estate, you had her trust, you had Leslie's estate. It was kind of all one big thing, and these trust assets were part of it, and it had a duty to protect them against claims that might come out of Brazil. And therefore, it was proper to hire Cooch and Taylor for $60,000. It was proper to hire an attorney in Brazil for $30,000. It was proper to pay certain expenses of Leslie in Brazil for another $10,000 or $11,000. All of that was necessary to protect these assets against Brazil. Well, if they stayed in trust, they petitioned for instructions to ask what would have happened. If they just left them in the trust and not put them in the estate, there'd never been any threat to these assets from Brazil. So I don't really see how you can justify $60,000 or $30,000, another $10,000 out of the estate, incurred by the estate, paid out of the trust, on this basis. Now, another reason given by the court below was all this was necessary for the orderly administration of Mrs. Chavin's estate. Well, respectfully, that's just not logical. All she had was a piece of real estate, the passable operation of law, and some things which she left to Leslie. You didn't have to hire Cooch and Taylor. You didn't have to spend $100,000 over here on Leslie's estate to do anything about her estate, but that's the reason given by the court below justifying the assessment of these fees against our clients. And I thought the most unusual one was the reason that, well, even if they kept the funds in the trust, probably somebody, Mr. Miller, or the Brazilian executor, would have sued the trust anyway. We'd had to go through all this anyway, and they would have incurred the same or similar fees and expenses. Now, that's purely speculative. There's nothing in the record at all that would support that. And again, it wouldn't have been necessary. You wouldn't have had to have a law firm with international expertise like Cooch and Taylor. You wouldn't need a Brazilian attorney if there had been a suit against the trustee to determine where the trust assets went. So that also doesn't really add up. And the fourth thing was that the will of Mrs. Chavin and the trust were complementary in that the trust was entitled to use trust assets to defer the administration costs of Mrs. Chavin's estate. That's true. But that's not what we're doing. We're deferring the administrative costs of Leslie's estate, and the trust doesn't provide for that. But anyway, those are the four reasons given, and we submit respectfully that that, under the Levitt versus Bouvier standard, doesn't really constitute the product of an orderly and logical deductive process. I just don't see how you justify that.
Could I interrupt so that I could get the numbers and the timing more clear? You said that estate expenses were charged to the trust to the tune of approximately $100,000. Are all of those post this court's decision expenses?
No, they were all before, I think.
Okay, so what expenses are you seeking that relate to any time period after this court decided to reverse?
The additional fees that PNC was required to pay to Mr. Perry's firm to represent it, according to my calculation, Your Honor, comes to about $35,000. The total amount of fees awarded by court below to Mr. Perry's firm was like $80,000. We did not oppose $37,000 of it because that was what ran through the appeal. And then in his answering brief, Mr. Perry pointed out it was another $7,000 that was attributable to that. That's fine, you can have that too. But we're simply saying, and we're not trying to take anything back from Mr. Perry, we're simply saying that there's $35,000 that we're now required to pay out of the trust for PNC's representation on matters post-dated this court's mandate, including their application to get fees for themselves, their application to get fees for the estate out of the trust, and their application to get fees on fees for proceeding, get that done, all of which, of course, was granted. It just boils down to, as I said before, we haven't done anything wrong, and there was a mistake in the distribution. There was the other thing I did leave out was the real estate. The real estate was sold, the proceeds were permitted by PNC to be distributed to Mr. Miller because they thought they had plenty of money in the estate, and that turned out they didn't. He's walked off $152,000 that was in the estate that could have been used to pay all these bills. He's got that and gone. We've got $130,000 of these state bills to pay. And I just don't see under any circumstances how this could amount to, you know, proper exercise of discretion. I say I only have about 3 minutes left, which I'd like to save to respond to the cross appeal, unless you have any further questions.
And very well.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Miller.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Berger, Justice Ridgely. Rick Miller on behalf of PNC. Before I get into the meat, I guess, of my argument, I would like to respond to a couple questions the court had asked Mr. Brown. The court had expressed an interest in learning more about the relationship between Harlan Miller and PNC throughout this litigation. Before the first appeal was decided, I think the record is very clear that PNC and Harlan Miller were on the same side of the case. Both parties filed answers opposing the complaint for declaratory judgment. Both parties submitted joint briefing, both in the Court of Chancery and before this court. That actually benefits the plaintiffs. We were not duplicating effort. We worked closely to make sure that the fees that we were charging based for that litigation and the fees that Mr. Herlihy was charging, which, by the way, ended up being awarded by the Vice Chancellor in an order that's not under appeal, that there was no duplication of effort. So to say that we worked close together, I think, was a benefit to the plaintiffs because there was no duplication of effort in the representation and the advocacy of the position that both had before the first appeal was decided. Now, after the first appeal was decided, I believe Mr. Brown conceded, and I think the record is quite clear, that PNC took a non-adversarial posture. Did we jump in as an advocate on the other side? The answer is no. The PNC made a decision at that point to adopt a neutral posture between the litigants.
And why was that, as opposed to after the remand from this court saying that as it did?
Well, we actually, Your Honor, we ended up filing, PNC ended up filing a petition for instructions at that point because we saw the arguments that were being raised by Harlan Miller, and you know, frankly, we thought that they were arguments that deserved at least a hearing. And because of that, we didn't feel it was necessary to advocate. Another thing is, again, that decision ends up helping the plaintiffs. Had we taken a more active role and had we submitted briefs in opposition to what Mr. Miller was saying, then we'd be submitting larger fee applications. So to me, it's a situation where, you know, what we did, the position that PNC took at that point, ends up benefiting the plaintiffs in the long run. And as it turns out, the Vice Chancellor ruled that the applications made by Harlan Miller could not be raised. He didn't rule against them on the merits. He ruled against them because he found that the Supreme Court mandate did not allow him to reach some of those issues. So we essentially maintained, PNC essentially maintained that neutral posture then throughout Harlan Miller's litigation, post-remand litigation. Then Mr. Miller filed an appeal to this court, which was then dismissed. And at that point, PNC made a decision that the litigation appears to be coming to a conclusion, and it should file its fee applications. And that's...
Let me focus on the expenses of Leslie's estate. Leslie is the deceased child, right?
Yes.
It seems that what PNC did was PNC undertook certain activities, which certainly might have been appropriate, but undertook them as in some relation in your capacity with respect to Leslie's estate, and then charged the trust for it. Isn't that what happened?
That is what happened. And
you know, to the extent that Leslie's estate is a separate entity with separate assets, where is it in the trust instrument that says that you're supposed to pay Leslie's estate's expenses out of the trust?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I don't accept the premise that PNC had separate assets in Leslie's estate at the time. The only significant asset that was in Leslie's estate was a piece of real estate.
And that you gave the proceeds to him?
Well, I would not agree with the court's statement that PNC gave the proceeds. What happened was there was a dispute over who was the beneficiary of Leslie's estate at the time. The plaintiffs had filed caveat to to Leslie Chavin's will. And if that caveat was going to be successful, then the plaintiffs would have been the intestate beneficiaries of Leslie Chavin's estate. Of course, Harlan Miller took the opposite view. He believed that he was the beneficiary of Leslie Chavin's estate. So the dispute was between Harlan Miller, represented by Mr. Herlihy on one side, and the Chavins, represented by Mr. Brown's firm on the other side.
Okay.
It was Mr. Brown's firm who said, if this property is sold, we want to make sure that the proceeds are escrowed.
Right.
Because if we succeed...
And were they escrowed?
They were. They were escrowed, and they remained in that escrow until Mr. Herlihy, representing Harlan Miller, wrote a letter to the escrow attorney and said, the will contest has been dismissed. In essence, I'm paraphrasing. The will contest has been dismissed. My client is the beneficiary of Leslie Chavins.
Okay. So in order to get to the bottom of this, what you're saying is that PNC was not responsible for dispersing those funds.
That's absolutely correct. I'm absolutely saying that.
But PNC was responsible for hiring attorneys to deal with potential problems with Brazilian law and Brazilian contests and so forth.
That's correct.
And that was entirely on behalf of Leslie's estate, right?
I disagree with that, Your Honor. What PNC did, PNC had an obligation as the trustee of the Florence Chavin Trust and as the executor of the Florence Chavin Estate, aside from
right.
being the administrator of Leslie Chavin Estate, had several obligations. They found, PNC made a decision, and Mr. Friedberg testified at the hearing about this, being the Cooch and Taylor attorney who represented PNC in these capacities. They determined that part and parcel of their administration of the Florence Chavin Trust and Estate was the establishment of an administration in Delaware for the Leslie Chavin Estate. They made that determination based on several factors. First of all, there were a lot of physical problems with this house. Okay, when Florence Chavin died, Leslie Chavin comes back to Delaware from Brazil and meets with the PNC representatives. At that time...
Well, let me interrupt because I really don't think, I may be wrong, but I don't think we need to hear every step on the road. What I'm trying to get a clearer picture on is if Leslie's estate has whatever problems it has, whether it's because the property has problems with it, whether it's because there are Brazilian laws that may apply, whether it's because there may be contests with respect to Leslie's estate. Whatever they may be, those are Leslie's estate's expenses, aren't they?
Again, Your Honor, the house had problems, a lot of problems, and that's clear in the record. The house was also full of furniture. It was all full of Florence Chavin's furniture. And that very, very expensive antiques that she did an extremely detailed personal memorandum passing these items to her estate, not through Leslie's estate, to Leslie Chavin and to the plaintiffs. This house is full of very valuable personal property.
Fine. What difference does it make whether there's an antique buffet and who it's going to go to that you need Brazilian lawyers for?
Well, I know it's a web, but this is the way PNC justifies it. In order to ensure the house and its contents, all right, which PNC has basically accepted a de facto custodial role for, PNC needs to get administration of Leslie Chavin's estate. It needs to be able to show its insurance company that it is the administrator of Leslie Chavin's estate. Problem is, Leslie Chavin is a Brazilian resident. He is not an American resident. He's not a resident of the state. So an estate here in Delaware, it can only be an ancillary administration, and it has to be ancillary to a Brazilian administration.
All right, let me cut through this, okay? Isn't the truth of the matter that PNC thought it was dealing with the entire trust and all of Mrs. Chavin's assets, and that it didn't really matter how it was broken down, because it, in the end, this was all coming out of the one big pot, and that after the fact, when it turned out that Mr. Miller is not the beneficiary, that then it's kind of sort of, all right, well, how do we justify having spent this money and charging it to the trust? I mean, isn't that what happened?
I agreed with Your Honor up to the very last couple sentences of Your Honor's statement. I don't think that PNC is engaged in any kind of post hoc recreation of events, but I do agree with the basic premise of what the court was saying, which is that PNC thought this was all one pot.
If we look at it somewhat differently, if you had the benefit of perfect 20/20 hindsight, perhaps the furniture would have been put in storage, the other things would have been done, because you would have known you were dealing with different people in different distributions. But at the time, this seemed to be the economical way to proceed.
I think that's all correct, Your Honor. And with the benefit of perfect hindsight, had PNC foreseen the interpretation that was going to be given to that trust instrument, I think PNC may have undertaken certain actions differently.
And so that goes back to Justice Berger's question. Now that we have the benefit of perfect 20/20 hindsight, why didn't PNC look at its expenditures and say, this is the way they should be allocated? It seems like the trust wound up with a disproportionate amount of the expenses.
Well, perhaps the easiest answer to that question is the fact that there's nothing left. There's nothing left but the trust. There are no assets in the Leslie Chavin estate. I mean, there's a small amount left, but even those assets, I think it's about $18,000. Even those assets are traceable to the trust. I mean, the trust is the only money right now that PNC has under its control.
What happened to Mr. Miller?
Mr. Miller is alive and well in New York, Your Honor.
But he received a distribution, didn't he?
He received a distribution not from the trust.
Not from the estate.
He received the house, which passed to him under Delaware law upon Leslie Chavin's death. And he received, I think he testified here, he received Swiss bank accounts that were also not under PNC's control.
So is it fair to say that because the person or entity that more properly should bear certain expenses isn't here or is judgment-proof, because of that, it's appropriate for the court to say, well, PNC acted in good faith, so take it out of the trust because that's the only money that's left. I mean, is that essentially what's going on here?
I would again disagree with the court's with the court's analysis, respectfully, Your Honor. I don't think that PNC is taking the position that these expenses should be borne by Harlan Miller. Our position is
because if you took that position, then what follows from that is go to Harlan Miller.
That's correct.
But knowing, as everybody does, that he's not a resource, isn't it, and didn't the court below, and aren't you basically arguing that, listen, PNC was doing what it thought was right, it now is entitled to be paid for its expenses, and there's only one pot to dig out of to get that payment?
And we would add to that statement that we believe it's an appropriate pot.
Let's suppose that Mr. Hurley, he hadn't written a letter and the money hadn't been released from escrow, and we did have two sources of money, the estate's money in escrow and the trust fund. Isn't the real question, if we were looking at the two sources of money, which should more appropriately bear these expenses?
If we still had that pot, that second pot of money, Your Honor, I would think that would be a legitimate concern. That would be a legitimate analysis whether or not that money should be used as opposed to the money coming out of the trust, knowing what we know now. Let me remind the court, though, that this money was released back in August of 2001, long before the Chancery Court had even ruled in this case. And the money that was spent in Brazil on the Brazilian administration was spent in June of 2000, 3 months before the declaratory judgment complaint on the trust was even filed.
Who should bear the risk of that release of that money prematurely?
I'm not certain.
Are you saying there's no, bottom line, there's no money in the estate to pay these expenses, so you're looking to the trust, and there's no money in the estate because the real estate proceeds were released, and too soon. Do you agree it was too soon to release it?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. No? And the only way that my whole point here is that money was out of PNC's control, because when Leslie Chavin died, Harlan Miller was the owner of that house. That house was Harlan Miller's to sell. There was no power given under the will of Leslie Chavin to PNC to sell that property. The only way PNC could have sold that property then, the only claim that PNC, as the executor of Leslie's estate, could have had on that property, administrator, I'm sorry, as a more appropriate term, would have been if the estate was insolvent. And at that time, August 2001, PNC would have had to make a petition that would be wildly inconsistent with the petition, with the position that PNC was taking in the trust litigation. Because PNC took the position that the Leslie Chavin estate was the owner of those trust funds. And that would have been a very inconsistent position to take.
Okay, well, let me go at it from a slightly different perspective, although following up on Justice Ridgely's question. When PNC was administrator of Leslie's estate, right? And as administrator, PNC was entitled to fees for various appropriate estate-related expenses, right? I mean, isn't that the law?
Yes.
Okay. So if PNC were keeping a list and saying, okay, well, you know, this estate involves the beneficiary here is a Brazilian resident, and you know, we've got some issues about Brazilian law, and you know, we better hire some attorneys in order to properly administer this estate. Those would all be appropriate expenses. I mean, if they were appropriate, they would be expenses that would be borne by Leslie's estate, right?
I think that's all correct.
Okay, and so what happened was that those expenses were incurred, but because PNC didn't expect the estate, Leslie's estate, to be that small, PNC did not do anything to protect its fees, the expenses it was getting paid from Leslie's estate. So, you know, you just said that it would have to be bankrupt in order to do anything with respect to the house. Isn't it kind of standard operating procedure that an administrator indicates claims that are against the estate and would say, you know, X amount for various attorney's fees?
I keep going back to the same point. I hope I'm not being repetitive, and I hope I'm answering the court's question. PNC didn't think that it was dealing with an insolvent estate. PNC at that time...
Okay, so PNC made a mistake, right?
I would say in retrospect, PNC did not foresee the right. ruling that the court would make on interpreting the trust.
Okay, fine. So PNC didn't foresee the extraordinary decision of the Supreme Court, if that's the way people want to interpret it. But the fact is, PNC had legal advisors and knew that there was a challenge, at least, coming with respect to the estate, that is, the Chavin estate. And yet PNC did nothing to protect its recovery of expenses as against Leslie's estate.
If Your Honor is just focusing on the release of the
right.
funds from the sale of the home,
right.
that is correct. PNC did nothing to stop those from being released. That's
okay.
correct.
Okay.
But
and now, having made that mistake, even though it was a perfectly good faith kind of mistake to make, but having made that mistake, now the trust is going to pay those fees. Right?
Well, I mean, PNC thinks that even aside from that the expenses are legitimate expenses that are that should be borne by the trust based upon the language of the trust instrument and based upon the overall aspect that PNC was taking these actions to preserve all of these assets. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honor, since we didn't get to the cross appeal, I'll simply rely on what's in my brief to address that. I think the court's questions indicate that you're, at least in our view, right on what the situation is and why that constitutes an abuse of discretion by the court below, which is not something I like to argue, I'd point out. But I think it's clear, PNC, for whatever its reasons, haven't doubted, acted in good faith. I bank at PNC, I've been there for years, I'm not mad at them, but they made a decision. And they stuck by it, and they took a position against the estate and the trust that Mrs. Chavin had set up, even though it was her fiduciary. They could have got a petition for instructions, got this whole thing over 5 years ago. They wouldn't have all this expense. We wouldn't be arguing about Brazil and all these other matters. They chose not to do that. And really, the way it worked, the thing that gets me about it all, I understand how the court below feels, and I'm fussed about that, but the result is, PNC, in good faith, doing what it thought was right, made a mistake. And it made a mistake, and it cost $130,000. And that mistake is being paid for by the trust. PNC isn't paying anything. They made the mistake. They're coming out of this cost-free. My clients, when I was here before, I told you I represented Mrs. Chapin, and I did. This time I'm representing her grandson, because this court said that money goes to them. That's where she wanted it to go. $130,000 plus is coming at it. Unnecessarily to pay for PNC's mistake. Now, you know, PNC's, last I saw it on the New York Stock Exchange, it's a Fortune 500 company, it's like 309th, I think it's rated. It had $6 billion in revenues last year. If it made a mistake for $130,000, it can eat one. I don't really see why it is. My clients, the appellants, have got to pay for their mistake, made in good faith, while they can have it cost free. But yet that's exactly what this decision comes down to. And I'll simply finish by saying this. Refer the court respectfully to the last paragraph in the statement of facts of my opening brief on page 17. I think that sums up the whole thing. I've given you particulars about the logical and deductive reasoning and the things that happened after mandate and all the things that shouldn't have happened in our view. But if you just look at that, that sums up the whole situation. And it's not refuted and anything is before the court. And therefore, we respectfully ask that the matter be reversed and quite frankly, if the court decides to affirm it, fine, that's the end of it. We won't be back to bother you again. If you do reverse it, I'd almost like to be heard on the mandate. I just don't want to go back to the court below again for more fees and that sort of thing, because we're going to end up paying. I want to be done. I want this case to be over with, and we respectfully give it to the court on that basis. Thank you for hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Thank you, Mr. Miller. The court appreciates your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement and we'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.